Commentator and journalist Chris Murphy knows what it's like to decide to make the unthinkable decision. At the heart of it was a crippling gambling addiction, after first placing a bet at the age of 17, as well as a battle with depression. For years, the gambling and the depression consumed him, and it eventually culminated in Chris deciding to take his own life. Thankfully, that unsuccessful attempt sparked things into action and led to his road to recovery. But recovery is tough, really tough. And if there's one key message Chris wants to get out there, you don't just magically get better. There are relapses, those battles still linger, but considering where Chris is now, he has made some inspiring progress. These days, Chris is also the gambling and education facilitator at Sporting Chance, the charity that was set up by former Arsenal captain Tony Adams, who himself battled with addiction. It provides services to professional sports people who are in need of mental health support, whether that is addiction related or anything else, and it's proved to be a vital lifeline for so many. This episode is a really powerful listen, as Chris goes into depth about what happened to him, but there is so much to take away by listening to his story. Chris, a big thank you for coming onto the podcast today and sharing your own particular story regarding mental health for our Mental Health Awareness Week podcast specials. I've got plenty to talk about, of course, throughout the course of this episode, including Sporting Chance, who you work for. But shall we begin then with your own personal story? Because I always think it helps people understand, basically, doesn't it, about what individuals have gone through and how much they understand the topic at hand, isn't it? So do you want to just take us through a bit of your story to start with? Because it centers around a gambling addiction, but there's other things that come into play as well. But essentially, well, it all start with a winning bet when you were aged, I think, 17.
Yeah, did. I thought it was where it started. And that's where it started in terms of physically gambling. But I will add a little bit of a caveat to that to say that actually, through some of the therapy and the work that I've done in recovery, I've looked earlier in life than that. And for example, I used to be obsessed with the National Lottery as a child. So I used to sort of write down the numbers that I thought would come out and be watching the balls come out of the machine and be getting that buzz then when I was probably, I think I was about 8 years old when the lottery started. So it was probably in me. Another example would be that I've got a brother not much older than me. And when we went to like the seaside or something, and my mum would give us both like a pound in 10p's or 2p's or whatever, and my brother would spend his on sweets and mine would be straight in the machines in the arcades and things. So I think that it was always kind of in me. And there were other things that I used to sort of do to excess as a child, whether it was food or playing computer games, but the actual gambling began when I was 17. Put a small accumulator bet on, and it won at odds of 175-1. That was my very first bet. The figures then, you know, it was hundreds of pounds rather than thousands, but for a 17-year-old lad, then hundreds of pounds was a lot of money. You know, as a college student who had a part-time job in a takeaway, I'd never held or seen that amount of money before. So yeah, that's where it started.
What do you put that, I don't want to call it an obsession, but that urge maybe to, you know, spend those pennies and things like you were talking about and put them in the machine. Can you put that down to something? Is that just a personality trait that has just been around? You've kind of had to balance as things have gone on.
Yeah, I don't know where it comes from. I know that like once I'd done it the first time, then you get a bit of a buzz out of it, a bit of excitement from it. So then you repeat that behaviour because you want to experience that again. I totally understand that. But I don't know where it came from inside me in the first place. I think perhaps, you know, a little bit of a need to escape. I always, even as a child, I always felt like I kind of wanted to be something or someone, and never really had come to terms with, like, it's okay just being me kind of thing. And you know, it's very, I had a very vivid imagination as a child, and would, you know, play with toys. And I mean, a lot of children do this sort of thing, but in my head it'd be something totally different, and I'd just escape to a bit of a dream world. And I think that when it came round to like the first the stuff I talked about with the lottery, the idea of winning a dream life, and then later on when I actually started gambling, I think that was probably at the heart of it, this opportunity to win the ultimate escape.
It's, I can kind of relate to it a little bit, not in a gambling sense, but in a sense of always looking for more. Yeah. Or like an adrenaline kick or something a bit more to your day than just, you know, waking up, doing your chores, going to bed type thing. Is that a little bit similar, where you're just always looking for like some sense of excitement to your day?
Absolutely, yeah. And I came from, you know, a small village in Huddersfield where everybody knew everyone, and people didn't really leave, you know, people really worked in the village or the town and had these sort of 9-to-5 sort of normal lives that I kind of deemed as a bit boring. You know, my parents, my mum and stepdad were very much to go out to work, earn the money, save the money. And I kind of thought they were a bit boring as well. And yeah, I think I did want more. And I think as a society, we're probably obsessed with more. I think the way that things are marketed towards us is all about more. If you eat this thing, you'll feel better. Or if you win this money, then you'll have a better life. And I think I kind of fell for it hook, line and sinker, really.
Mm-hmm. How did that then develop? Because it's essentially, I mean, we're trying to condense, I suppose, 6 years worth of time into you kind of spiraling a little bit out of control. Was it something that gradually built up, or was it just kind of take over your life a bit?
For me, it was pretty instant. For many people, it's kind of a slow, subtle thing. But for me, it was pretty quick. I was 17, so second year of college, and I didn't even get to the point of sitting my A-levels, because in this short window of time, I just got obsessed with gambling and drinking, basically going to pubs, drinking, playing on fruit machines, or going to the bookies, betting on sports, betting on the roulette machines. When I turned 18, then casinos. But yeah, I got thrown out of college because I just weren't attending lessons, because I was doing that instead. And yeah, I mean, it's probably easy for me to kind of sum it up that period of time, because in that 6 year period, I probably gambled every day. And if that was, you know, looking down the back of the sofa to find 20 pence, because that's all I had and needed a rush, so I'd get like some sort of horse racing accumulator on just so I had the blood pumping around my body again, and that'd be that. Or if I'd been doing quite well, it might be going down the casino with a few thousand pounds in my back pocket, all in secret. No one really knew how much I was winning or losing. But yeah, it was it got hold of me really, really quickly, and it kind of became my life for the next 6 years.
Did that kind of follows on to my next one. Did people know? Did your family spot that something was up, but maybe not realize extent?
My mum knew pretty quickly. After that very first bet, I actually phoned my nan to get her to work out how much I'd won, because she used to work in a betting shop, and she gave me a real like stark warning. I remember it now on the phone. And she gave me a real stark warning, saying, "I've seen this a thousand times. Don't go down this road, you know, just enjoy the money and don't gamble again," basically. And so my mum, having been brought up by a parent who worked in a betting shop, was kind of aware of the problems that could exist. And she, after I think a bad spell, she took me to Gamblers Anonymous when I was 18. So very early in that journey. And I went to kind of please her, but I didn't really pay any attention in the meetings or do anything. And then when she stopped taking me, I stopped going and actually went to the bookies in that time instead. So she thought I was going to Gamblers Anonymous meetings, but I was going to the bookies instead and coming home pretending that that's where I've been. So she knew. And then in terms of, I moved out of home pretty quickly because it facilitated the lifestyle that I wanted to live. I didn't have to be bound by my parents' rules then. And in that next sort of 5 years, my friends all knew that I gambled a lot and maybe had a bit of a problem, but I don't think any of them really realised it'd become actually an addiction and a dependency.
When does the turning point come in, as in when you realise this is doing serious damage to you, or when it comes to a point where you think you want to try and take your own life?
I think it stops working. I think that I said at the very beginning that gambling for me offered an escape in the same way that alcohol does for many people, or drugs. And gambling offered an escape for me, always offered me the hope. What started to happen, and I think this is where there is a difference really between this kind of addiction and something that is more substance-based, is that it was actually offering me escape from the problems that it had created. So I was getting into all sorts of debt, spirals of depression and anxiety, and, you know, low self-esteem, low self-worth, jobs, losing relationships, losing friendships, all these things, all caused by gambling. Yet I had this unwavering belief that gambling was going to be the thing that would get me out of it. And I think when I got to the point that I started to realise that actually, you know, you've given this a really good go and it's not really worked. It's not really working out, and it might not work. I decided to kind of take the ultimate gamble. And I had, again, at the moment, I was only thinking financially, as if paying everyone back what I owed them would make up for all the lies and all the hurt and all that. I worked out how much I owed people and saw how much money I had available. And I said to myself, I'm going to win everything back and start again, clean slate, or I'm going to end my own life. In 2010, I went about doing that. And actually, it was one of the weirdest gambling days I'd ever had, because usually would sort of be up and down for a bit. I think I literally was in the bookies for about 20 minutes. I just lost every single bet that was there, and then went home and started to make plans to take my own life.
What a choice to for your own brain to be making for yourself. It's mad, isn't it? What, I don't know if you saw the Roman Kemp documentary for Comic Relief. I've name checked it a few times on this podcast now, because it's honestly such an eye-opening documentary, that, and the part in it where he asked someone who was contemplating and trying to take their own life what exactly was going through their brain, because if you're not in that position, it's really hard to comprehend, isn't it?
Yeah.
And is there a way that you've been able to sort of describe, or at least try and make it relatable to people who've not been in that position, what exactly was going through your head? Because it's a drastic decision to make, isn't it?
The one thing that I can remember thinking all the time was that whenever I'd heard people talk about suicide in the past, they'd spoken it as a selfish thing to do. And actually, the thing that was going through my head the most was, everybody else will be better off if I'm not here anymore. It wasn't really about me. It was like, my mum won't have to worry anymore, and my friends won't have to have that dilemma whether they lend me the money, whether they're actually funding my addiction, and all that kind of thing. Maybe it was a way out. Part of it would have been, it was a way out of all the problems that were seemingly insurmountable for me. But the overriding thought was that actually not I will be better off, but the world will be better off without me in it.
What happens next then? As in, you know, you try and take your own life, but, you know, what's the turning point sort of thing?
I go up to my friend's room. I was living in a shared house, four of us. Ironically, they were all at the races that day. I'd not gone because I was trying to sort out my gambling problem. In their eyes, because, you know, it got to a stage where it had become apparent by then that I had a problem. And again, I'd been doing something similar with them that I'd been doing with my mum all those years before, which was sort of saying I'm going to get help and not. Went up to his room because I knew he took sleeping tablets. So I thought I could find his sleeping tablets, take an overdose of them, and that would be the way that I would go. On the side, I saw loads of pound coins. He'd dropped the fruit machine the night before or something and left like these pound coins there. I think there was 50 quid. So it gives me one little last light bulb of hope, I suppose, as if like, oh, that they've been put there by some, you know, divine being for me to go and win all this money back with 50 quid, you know. And I went to the bookies and they're putting pound coins into the roulette machine, and lost that pretty quickly as well. So stole that money from him, lost that, went back there, opened the drawer, found some tablets, went down to my room. I actually wrote a suicide note, and I wrote a poem as well, describing how I felt, and left them. I put them inside my bedside drawer, because I thought that if anyone was worried, I didn't want them to find it immediately, because I wanted to, it was a serious thing. I didn't want, you know, it wasn't people say cry for help and all that for me. It was a genuine attempt. And I left home and walked up onto the moors near where we live, sat on a bench, took with me, I think, a bottle of beer and something to eat, bizarrely, like some kind of last rites thing, and took that and swallowed the tablets, and then waited for them to have any effects. Fortunately, they didn't have any effect, and it turned out that I'd taken the wrong tablets. I'd attempted to overdose on his hay fever tablets, believe it or not. But yeah, and I get really bad hay fever now, so that's kind of always a bit of a reminder of what happened. But yeah, I mean, that's just one of those, you know, by the grace of God things, I suppose, because I genuinely thought in that sort of muddled state, that's what I was doing, that's what I was attempting to do. I just started walking around, and then my next door neighbour, I used to spend a lot of time with, did get worried that they'd not seen me that day. They had a key to our house. They found the suicide note, contacted my parents, and my parents started driving around and eventually found me just sort of walking around like a zombie, really, and took me home, made me throw up, phoned the NHS and all that sort of thing, and had a big sort of heart-to-heart with my mum. And I can just remember her. It was the first time I'd really been honest with anyone about the extent of the problem. And I can just remember that she kept saying, "Is there anything else?" And she must have asked that question at like 50 times. And there was always something else. And she had to sort of get it all out of me. So yeah, and then the next day I went to a meeting. And even though I've not been abstinent from gambling ever since, I've been going to meetings or pursuing some form of recovery ever since.
Was that, I suppose, hitting rock bottom, essentially, and it forcing you to be open and honest with your family and your mum? Does that essentially mark the turning point where you realise I've got to do something seriously now?
I find that a difficult question, because many people who share their story of addiction and recovery to whatever it might have been will have that definitive rock bottom, and then they never did it again. They went through recovery and they never did it again. Where mine's been a story of, you know, quite regular relapse. At the moment, I'm 2.5 years abstinent from both gambling and alcohol, and that's the longest period that I've ever done. And I do feel that I'm finally on the right path. So what I would say is, yes, that was a rock bottom. I'm not sure you can get sort of lower than attempting to take your own life mentally. But I suppose I've kind of almost been there again, or you know, maybe my rock bottom had a bit of a trap door or something like that, because, you know, later on I've been suicidal again, but not actually acted on it. A couple of times I've sort of had to really, really sort of white knuckle through that feeling. And another time I've actually, because I've known what to do, I've contacted like a mental health crisis team and got support for it that way. But I've had like really low moment since then after relapses, because I suppose before, when I was gambling every day, kind of became automatic, and I'd not really got anything in life and didn't really have anything to lose, or didn't feel like I did, because I'm talking sort of material things then. And but as I abstained, I think the first time that after that episode that we just spoke about, I think I abstained for 18 months straight off the bat. And that was a combination of going to meetings, the pain that I was in, not wanting to go back there, and quite practical things like not really having much access to my own money and stuff like that. And the times that I've relapsed have almost been harder to take than back then, because, you know, in the periods of absence, I would build my life up, I'd build my finances up, I'd have healthier relationships, and I just feel like I'd pull the rug from under my own feet. And that was, so, you know, almost harder to come back from than the 6 years of gambling every day.
I think a lot of people can fall into that trap, can't they, where they just think life is linear. You go down, you go up, and so on. You know, you crash back down to earth, and then you recover, and that's it. But onto the recovery side of things now, it's almost a bit cyclical, isn't it? Where you can fall back to where you were before without really meaning to or intending to. And does that ultimately sum up what recovery is like for a lot of people? Because it's not as simple as just getting better, is it?
Exactly, yeah. And I think, I honestly believe that my story is like probably the most common story, but it's the one that gets told the least. There are those people who run into problems with something, get help for it, and do manage to stay away from it for the rest of their lives. It doesn't mean that their life's perfect and in any way, you know, they go through their own issues too, but they manage to navigate those issues without turning back to their addiction. And then there are other people who we hear about who couldn't seem to tackle their addiction, and they end up, unfortunately, you know, taking their own life or just living a life where they just surrender to the addiction. I think actually my experience is probably shared by quite a lot of people, whatever process of recovery they pursue, because I do believe that different things work for different people. You know, it's up and down, and you know, relapse isn't the end of the world. It is really, really difficult to come back from, and I've kind of tried approaching it in many different ways. I've tried to moderate gambling, seeing if that would work. It didn't. I ended up gambling like a lot worse than probably did before, because I wouldn't get the same buzz. You know, if you're someone who likes getting drunk at the weekend, but you try and restrict yourself to one pint and it doesn't really have that effect, it won't take long before you just say, right, go on, pass me the vodka or whatever it is that would give you that effect. So it was the same for me with like amounts of money. I think, like, I've never done the maths rationally, but I think I almost need to be able to lose everything. And I need to be like risking everything for it to light that fire inside me and to give me the proper adrenaline rush and to release that dopamine and stuff in my head. So yeah, I think it is very, very up and down, and life's up and down. I've had many, many episodes of depression. I've got anxiety that I think is linked to, for example, when I used to owe people money. So I'd walk into a pub and I'd pretend to be on the phone, because if someone was in there that I owed money to, I could sneak out the back door without having to speak to them and things like that. So when I go into a new place now, I still feel that sort of phenomenon, that feeling of, you know, dread, anxiety, who might be here, who's like looking at me, what are they? And I've got nothing to worry about now. And it's, you know, people who didn't know me then and things like that. But also I've had periods of depression and gambling, alcohol, drugs, these things are kind of painkillers to me. So if I'm in pain, I'm naturally going to reach to something that can take me out of that pain. And many, many times I've gambled to medicate depression without knowing that that's what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, in terms of the depression, anxiety thing, side of things, how, because it must be so hard to manage that side of your life when you can kind of feel or sense that you're going through a bad period for whatever reason. And I suppose, is it still very much just trying to juggle that versus your own self-worth and trying to light that fire, like you said, wherever possible, which is a lot easier said than done.
Yeah, I think I made the mistake, and perhaps many people who've suffered with addiction problems make the mistake of putting everything that goes wrong in their life or every issue they have in life down to their addiction. And actually, we're not very good at talking about it, and, you know, podcasts like this will help. But we've all got mental health, just like we've all got physical health. And, you know, other people have anxiety and depression that haven't had an addiction problem. And so it's, what is difficult for me is to kind of separate the two and to actually think, like, we've all got a kind of innate desire to make sense of everything. So like, oh yeah, that's why I'm like that, because I went through this addiction thing. But actually, you know, sometimes it's possibly just chemical. You know, sometimes it's just biological. Sometimes it's not anxiety, it's just fear, like naturally, it's just nervousness. Or sometimes, you know, it's just like I recently had a bout of depression. It was the first time that I've not attempted to self-medicate it through alcohol or gambling. And I don't know where it came from. You know, I've got no idea, but perhaps it wasn't a cause. And that's the thing, you know, I think that's the thing. So I think, yeah, I've kind of gone both ways, really. I think I spent all that time for that 6 years we spoke about before being in denial about being in addiction. And then the sort of following 7 or 8 years where I was seeking recovery but relapsing quite often, I was probably allowing my addiction to define me so much that it was almost inevitable that I would turn back to that. whenever I suffered any problems.
How are you now, anyway, in terms of letting it define you, or rather, I suppose, maybe taking ownership of it so that it doesn't dictate who you are as a person?
Yeah, I think I see addiction as something that I have, but not something that I am, you know. And I think one of the issues I sometimes have when I go to recovery meetings is this sort of declaration of I am an addict. And I suppose I was an addict, and I'm either a recovering or recovered addict. I suppose I would lean toward recovering, but you know, other people have different opinions on that. But I think I've stopped letting it define me. And we talk about stigmas a lot in mental health, but actually the biggest stigma for me existed in my own head. And even recently, when I went through that bout of depression, I was telling myself that I had no reason to be depressed. I'm not depressed. I've got all the symptoms of depression, but I'm not depressed. If I'm not going to work, then they're going to think that I'm taking the mick, you know, they won't believe me, all that kind of thing. And if anybody else would have said that stuff to me, I would have, like, you know, I would have been really annoyed and tried to put them straight and educate them on mental health. But in my own head, all that stuff was still going on. So it's very difficult sometimes to, like, to say, like, yeah, I work for a mental health charity and I've got a lot of experience in all these kind of things. But where am I with addiction and mental health? I still think I'm a bit mixed up with it all at times. I think I accept that what happened, and that I'm on a program of recovery, and that I get help and support to tackle my addiction and my mental health problems. But I still think there are a lot of blurred lines for me that are unresolved, that I'm working to resolve. And perhaps, maybe, you know, it doesn't all need to be resolved. Maybe it's enough to sort of go to the doctor and, like, if I've got a broken leg, I'm not going to say to him, well, can you tell me exactly how it happened, you know, before he starts fixing it? And I think sometimes with mental health, we try to do that.
It's the phrase practice what you preach always comes up, doesn't it? Mm. And it's, again, easier said than done. It's all well and good, you know, giving advice to people, knowing what you should do. But when it's yourself, and owning it yourself and coming to terms with it about yourself, it's a whole different ball game, isn't it?
Absolutely.
In terms of, I suppose it comes back to taking ownership as well, but I suppose specifically on the male mental health side of things, and being able to be open about things like that, because you mentioned stigmas before, and there's probably still very much an air of that, particularly with the male mental health side of things and the man up connotations, if you like.
Yeah.
Is that still very much something that perhaps goes on in your own head, as well as the head of countless other men across the world, that we can really start trying and take down that narrative for the better of everyone else, really?
I think so, yeah. I think so. I think, you know, admitting vulnerability really is not a sign of weakness. And I think we kind of probably think to ourselves it is, whatever environment we're working, whether, you know, it's a professional sports person or someone who works in the media or someone who works in an office or a physical, you know, manual job. I think that culture does still exist. I think there are a lot of stereotypes where they think, oh, it exists within builders, but not within, you know, a different environment of the workplace. And I think it still does. I think we all want to portray ourselves as these perfect sort of infallible beings. Social media probably plays a massive role in that as well. But actually, you know, we're all a little bit rough around the edges, and we you know, life, as you said before, is not like linear. It's not even the question that you asked earlier, how are you now? In some areas, it's probably 10 out of 10, and some areas, it's probably 1 out of 10. But when can you ever, apart from in therapy and in that kind of environment, give a genuinely honest answer to that question when people ask if you're okay or not? So I just think that the only way to break down that stigma, that barrier, that sort of kind of toxic masculinity, is to share your own authentic truth and be honest about how you feel, and completely own how you feel unashamedly.
This podcast is a member of The Bear, internet radio and podcast network. Find more great podcasts at thebear.live.
Mental Health Awareness Week is hosted by the Mental Health Foundation. You can find more information and support it at www.mentalhealth.org.uk. I'll move on to Sporting Chance now, because obviously it's a large part of your life at the moment, at the same time, with your role there, particularly as gambling education facilitator as well.
Yeah.
Read my own writing. What do you want to just tell us a little bit about Sporting Chance and what it offers, but also what why it was set up in the first place and what its purpose is and why it's needed?
Yeah, so Sporting Chance was set up by the former England and Arsenal captain, Tony Adams, just over 20 years ago, in the year 2000, basically because he had his well-documented problems with addiction, alcoholism primarily, and when he got sober, he had a lot of other sports people coming to him and sort of saying, well, how did you do that? Where did you get the help to do that? And he decided to set something up for sports people because there just wasn't anything. There was no obvious go-to place. So initially it started as a residential clinic for addiction, which still exists today. But now it has grown to become the biggest provider of mental health services to elite sport in the world, with a global counselling network. I think around 16 stakeholders across 11 sports, including some world tours, so like the ATP, PFA, the Premier League, the FA. I'll mention the PDPA because that's how I got involved in Sporting Chance, through the Professional Darts Players Association. When I'd had a relapse a couple of years ago, they put me in touch with Sporting Chance. As a quirk of fate, I now work for both organisations. I initially went there for support and treatment. Not just for addiction, any mental health issue, Sporting Chance is there to provide specialist, confidential treatment and support for professional sports people. We also do outreach work as well. So we go into a lot of clubs and organisations to provide education on issues that we're seeing in clinics. So yeah, the addictive stuff, the gambling stuff, which I play a big part in, but also on anxiety, on things like transition. From being a professional sports person to, you know, whatever else life has in store, because a lot of people struggle with that whenever it happens. So anything to do with mental health in sport, Sporting Chance is there.
Is mental health in elite sports people something that perhaps went under the radar and still maybe goes under the radar in some aspects? Because people can see it as like just the dream scenario, can't they? But it's got so much to it. And Lizzie Simmons, the swimmer, former swimmer, is someone who speaks so brilliantly on it, about how, like you say, the transition. And when she retired, she went, I don't know what I'm doing now. I don't know what my life is. I was Lizzie the swimmer for so long, but now I don't have swimming anymore. So what do I do with my life?
Yeah.
And is that something that's really quite prominent in the elite sports person
world? I think so. And when you consider, for example, in football, for the majority of people, that happens when they're in the teens because they don't go on to make it. So they've been the footballer since they were 6, 7, 8 years old, and they've got they're on the books of Man United or someone like that, and everything seems to happen, and the majority of them don't make it. So that happens to people in the teens. You think about the ones who've had the career. So we're working with all areas of elite sport, and I think there are very different challenges. I think it all comes down to the fact that we're all human beings. And actually, some people in higher profile, perhaps more privileged roles, may be more susceptible to mental health issues than people in I don't like the phrase, but I'm going to use it because people understand it, like in everyday life. Because of the pressures, the unique pressures that come with that. You know, like I've got a couple of jobs. No one's really trying to take my place in the team. Like, I don't have to worry if I'm going to get picked this week to work and things like that. I don't have to worry that I'm going to get injured and that'll be the end of my career. So there are all sorts of things that sports people have to worry about, like whether it happens or not. And you know, they need support with those things. And I think then that combined with what we were talking about before, the need to appear strong, resilient, you know, that kind of culture to seem invincible, really, for a lot of people, even though that, you know, sports got a lot better and society's got a lot better, it still exists in all of our heads. And I'm sure it still exists in all of the heads of the sports people do not want to show any sign of what they perceive as weakness.
Absolutely. Is that part of the key as well, is normalizing conversations like this for people across society, like you say, including sports people, that it's okay to show that vulnerability if that's what you happen to be going through at that particular time?
Absolutely. And again, I think it comes back down to that, like, how do you define yourself as a human being? And where I'm not Chris the gambling addict, you know, nobody is John the footballer, because they're also a husband and a father and a friend and a son and, you know, a dog walker and, you know, a comedian or whatever it is that they have in their life. And I think that desire to live up to the label that you've either put on yourself or had put on you, it is a big problem. But I would say that with Sporting Chance, the service is completely confidential. So even if you can't bring yourself to speak to your friends or your family or speak publicly about those issues, you can speak to a therapist in confidence and just kind of break down some of those barriers in your own head within that kind of confidential professional environment.
This is partly Sporting Chance related, but partly society related as well.
Yeah.
How do you think the pandemic has impacted things? Because I think we see, you know, the rise in mental health call outs for police and things like that. And I think we're all pretty much sure that it's had quite a horrible effect on a lot of people, what with isolation and things like that. But I wonder if it's had that impact on sports people at the same time, when calendars have been shifted around, mm-hmm. racing, for example, hasn't been able to happen, competitions that you were banking on, then you get injured and then get delayed and you're not able to get yourself in the same sort of position. So I always consider how much the pandemic has had an impact on people's mental health, but I always feel like once we're out of the COVID pandemic, there's probably something we're going to have to pick up afterwards, mental health wise, that we're really going to have to look at and take care of, isn't there?
Yeah, I'll try and answer on both levels. Interestingly, at Sporting Chance, during the first few weeks of the first lockdown, the phone lines went quiet. Fewer people are reaching out for help. And, you know, it's for anyone to make their own assessment of why that might be. I suppose we'll never know. But one idea is that actually these people that have been, you know, living a certain way, a disciplined way of life for a long time, actually had a bit of time with their families and a bit of freedom and a bit of, you know, there were benefits. There were some benefits to that happening for some people, because it forced people who were, I'm not just talking about sport, but people who were maybe working a little bit too much, not spending time with their families, it forced them into an environment, forced them to stop and maybe reflect and slow down. With Sporting Chance, then what happened over a period of time is that the phone line started picking up again. And it was almost like, if you could encapsulate the whole of Sporting Chance's inbound phone calls to the helpline as like one person, it was like, didn't phone for the first few weeks. Then after a few weeks, started to phone saying they're having some emotional problems. And then after that, started to phone saying, actually, I've got a problem with drugs or alcohol or gambling. I think there was one week where nearly every phone call was about gambling addiction. And you can almost imagine this idea of a sports person who's got this free time, then all of a sudden starts feeling unsettled because, right, they're ready to go back now. And then starts putting it somewhere, just like I shared in my story, and maybe develop a gambling addiction. And then, so I think it really did affect sport at first, And now you've got the reverse of it, where, as you said, they're kind of catching everything up and like working probably harder than ever without a rest, but also in a really demanding environment where, I mean, I go to darts events as a commentator, you've got to get tested and then quarantine in your room for 24 hours before you can enter the arena and things like that, and all the social distancing measures and everything that were in place in order for the event to go ahead. That in itself is challenging, demanding, sad, you know, sad to look around and think that you kind of got to live in that way. So I think there are loads of pressures that the pandemic has put on professional sports people. I don't think it's massively changed the amount of people that we've helped year on year. I think it's probably slightly down on the previous year. I think I'm right in saying that. But it's quite similar to the amount of people who helped in the last couple of years at Sporting, in the last few years at Sporting Chance over a 12-month period. I think in society, I think that again, like different people have been through different phases with this. I was kind of fine for most of 2020, but I think I really struggled this year. I think I've kind of got some kind of fatigue. I think I did. You know, it was horrific, everything that was going on and all the problems and the fact that people are losing their livelihoods and their lives to this, you know, disease. Personally, I wasn't too affected. Like, nobody I knew was really affected by it, and it didn't stop me from working. It changed the way that I worked, but it didn't stop me from working. And, you know, I had a lot of free time, managed to move house, and, you know, a lot of exciting things happened in that period as well for me. But I think, like, I'm one of those people who've kind of had this lockdown fatigue, this pandemic fatigue, and maybe that was a factor in the depression that I suffered as well.
Yeah, and I'll be honest and say that I found the first 3 months of this year really, really hard. Mm. And I'm also someone who's very affected by the weather.
Yeah.
Which is why I didn't, the first lockdown I found okay to deal with, because you were able to get out and about, and the weather was broadly speaking quite good. So you go for runs, go for walks, whatever. But then the first 3 months of this year, I found so monotonous. Just the same thing, the same thing, the same thing. And spending, 11, 12 hours a day in this room, as lovely as it is, working. And then having nothing to do in the evenings but just sit there and then watch TV maybe, then wait for the next day to come around.
Completed Netflix already in the first lockdown. So.
Exactly, and there's only so many Marvel films I can watch.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think now that stuff is opening up and even just getting to go out to a park again, compared to the first 3 months of this year anyway, I think has helped massively, certainly in my own case.
I think it comes down to that, kind of become an unintended theme of our discussion. I think it comes back down to that word hope again. I think that maybe we started to just run out of hope a little bit and started to think, you know what, maybe it is going to be like this forever. And now that things are starting to open up again, we've got that bit of hope. And I have kind of put that down as that's what I need, but maybe that's what we all need. And I look for it in unhealthy ways, when actually there are very healthy ways to have that.
Yeah, exactly. It makes sense, doesn't it? If you've got that hope, then it's something that will light your fire and get you going and get you driving again and driving for what you want.
Yeah, definitely. It's hard to work from home when you kind of sat there thinking, what is it for? Like, what am I going to spend the money on? What I'm not allowed out of this room, basically. So yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, to have that little sense of hope in that environment.
Exactly. Spending the money on all orders online. I think I know my Hermes man's name off by heart now.
So yours is Hermes, mine was Domino's, I think.
In terms of what more can be done to try and help normalize these conversations, try and educate people, make people aware, what else is there that we can look at in the near future, particularly picking out something from Sporting Chance anyway, the need for independent, safe places to go to, and how much help that would have if there were more on offer?
Yeah, I think that my domain is gambling in terms of education and knowledge, really, because that's my own personal experience and an area that I've researched quite a lot. I think one of the things that happens in gambling addiction and recovery, and again, rightly or wrongly, or perhaps neither, is that a lot of that stuff is funded by or provided, even provided by, in some occasions, the gambling industry themselves. So I think when we talk about a need for independent, safe spaces, we're not saying that those types of organisations shouldn't exist or shouldn't have, shouldn't be able to educate or treat people with that problem, or people who want to know about, you know, the dangers of it, but that there should always be an independent, safe alternative. When you look at some sponsorship deals, for example, they'll have a social responsibility attached to them, but that means that the company that is providing that sponsorship, that is, I'm not going to say the cause of the harm, because again, I'm not sure that's necessarily accurate, but certainly a facilitator of the harm for some of the people that are going through that stuff, are the ones that are tasked with providing that education and providing that treatment and providing that consultation to people on how to deal with this problem in terms of both treatment, education and prevention. So I think that what Sporting Chant provides and what many other organisations provide is like an independent, safe space in those domains where they're not attached to the industries that contribute to the harm of their client population. But I just think in general as well, like people, I'm very, very fortunate that I go to recovery meetings where there's a community of people who are recovering from addiction and can sit in a room of other like-minded people with no agenda, no judgment, and just get off my chest what's going on for me and learn from them, you know. And then I've got a therapist that I see every week that I can go and do the same thing. So I've got two in my own life independent safe spaces that I can go, and it really, really helps. I think the therapy, I think it's starting to change here, but the therapy culture, like for example in America, it's like quite normal to say you're going to see a therapist. But if I say that I can't meet you at 10 o'clock for that coffee tomorrow because I'm seeing my therapist, whoa, what's wrong? Why, what's going on? It's like, that, well, I'm trying to stop things being wrong by seeing my therapist. And yeah, I think that like just changing, there's still a lot to be done in terms of changing the approach towards mental health. People talk about parity between mental health and physical health being the aim, Sporting Chant included, and I would totally agree with that. I think the easiest way to kind of get people to understand that is to kind of just talk about health, because mental health is physical health. You know, it's the same thing, it's health. And if something's wrong with my leg or my arm, I won't think twice about going to see the doctor. But if something's wrong with my mind or emotionally, you know, with my heart, if you want to put it that way, then for some reason, I start to think, well, I should be able to get through this with my own devices. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with asking for help, because if you compare it against something physical, you wouldn't think twice about it.
Yeah, to use the broken leg example that you gave before, you wouldn't just be like, I can deal with that, and then continue with the rest of your day, would you? Yeah. So yeah, thinking of it very much in the same wavelength, we can do the world of good.
We treat our mental health, sweeping generalisation, but we often treat our mental health through trial and error, and we just wouldn't do that with anything physical.
Yeah, exactly. Perfectly summed up. One question I've been asking everyone as well, considering the theme of this week's Mental Health Awareness Week, and that's nature, for obvious reasons, I think, considering what we've all been through in the last year and a bit. How has sort of nature and the outdoors benefited you? And is it something you've maybe rediscovered just how important it is over the last year?
Absolutely, yeah. You mentioned before, actually, one of the things that you said, but if you know what to do, but when you're feeling a certain way, it's very difficult to do it. And having just recently been through a period of depression, one of the big things that helped was getting out for a walk. And some days I couldn't do that and would berate myself, because I knew it would help, but just couldn't do that. But just getting outside, fresh air, you know, getting moving, something as simple as that, really has made a difference to my life, not just now, but last year, when the first lockdown hit, when we, I think this happened to a lot of people, when we were sort of told you're allowed to go out for half an hour. Like, I probably didn't always go out for half an hour before that. And then all of a sudden, like, felt, well, I better take advantage of this. And at the time, I was living in quite a small studio flat, to put it kindly, bedsit would be a better description, with my girlfriend. And we were both working from home. Like, she was on the sofa and I was on like a table, like 3 feet away. And it was quite a difficult, you know, working arrangement, but we've made it work by basically closing our laptops at 5 o'clock, putting everything away, leaving the flat, going out for the walk and coming home as if we'd been to a place of work. And that was like walking home. So then it really, really helped as well. Just being outside, stretching the legs. And I think for me, like I miss things like five-a-side football and stuff like that. That's maybe the social element and the fun element, because I'm not someone who can exercise if it's not fun. I can't just go to a gym by myself or just go running on my own. I have to like sort of almost trick my brain into thinking it's not exercise to, in order to do it. But walking, I really enjoy. I used to always have to have headphones in and be listening to a podcast or an audiobook. And actually, a lot of the time now, I'm just sort of looking up, really, and appreciating what's around me. And I think that's something that probably... well, two things really. The pandemic has really sort of made hit home, but also, like, I used to spend 36 hours in a dark casino sometimes, you know, or I'd be stood at the window of a bookies on a roulette machine watching other people cycle past or walk past with a dog or whatever it might be, and I thought I was the winner and they were the losers, and actually, you know, it was kind of the other way around.
Exactly, yeah. You compare it to things like that, and it does show just how much has changed as well with your own backstory too, and where you are at now. And likewise, again, I can relate with that, particularly sort of the running, I think, has particularly helped me at the moment, just for a change of scenery rather than just the middle of nowhere village that I currently live in. Just running to the next town, for example, just to see something different. And likewise, the sports side of it really does, it's having that to go to really helped me before the pandemic, and that's one thing I cannot wait to get back to. Fencing being my sport, so proper niche. Wow. But also an indoor sport that has not been able to get back underway just yet, but in time. But again, what I'll touch on that now is having sport, whether you're an athlete or not, and we are not, having that to go and have that release must will make the world of difference at the same time, and ultimately shows, as we bang on about in this podcast quite a lot, how important sport is at a societal level, not just in terms of your elite athletes.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that I've looked forward to is just watching football, for example. I mean, you can watch football every day at the moment, but I think just watching football for me personally, obviously the darts when I'm commentating, it's something to look forward to. I think we were talking about before that thing about hope and having things to look forward to. An athlete that, whether it's an elite athlete or a pub team footballer, they've got Saturday or Sunday to look forward to every week. You know, there's another match, even if they lost the last one. I think the release as well of physical exercise. I think with mental health, whether you're talking about treating a mental health condition, or just managing your own mental health, there's a physical element to that as well. And we all know that, like, releasing endorphins through exercise helps our mental health. But when this goes out, my feelings about football might be slightly different. I'm a Sheffield Wednesday fan, and they will have played Derby by the time this goes out, and may or may not be in the third tier of English football once again. So perhaps good that you caught me this week, because it might have been a different answer, because I certainly won't be looking forward to League One football if that's how it goes.
And of all things, we've managed to get a Sheffield Wednesday fan and Ryan Conway, the Derby County writer for The Athletic, on this particular series, and he said very much the same thing. See what happens.
Yeah, well, at the moment, to kind of bookend it in the right theme, at the moment, I've still got hope, and didn't think we would have a few weeks ago. So,
fingers crossed. As a West Ham fan, my mood is very different
I can imagine.
After this season. My final question then, for people who want to reach out to Sporting Chance or if they need any help, where can they go to get more information or any more resources that might help them?
So for Sporting Chance, that's if any professional sports people were listening to this and they would be able to access Sporting Chance's services. All the information will be on the website. Just Google us and we're the first thing that comes up. We're also on Instagram. It's the only social media we've got, but that's at Sporting Chance Clinic. And anyone can follow us there. We try to post mental health tips and, you know, stuff on there that might be of benefit to anyone, whether they're able to access our services or not. For anyone else, there are loads of organisations I'm sure you'll be promoting them throughout the course of the week that can help. I've had therapy and things through different organisations. I go to one of the 12-step anonymous groups as well, so people who are struggling with addiction, you know, they're good. The Northern Gambling Service, which you mentioned earlier, I sit on an experts by experience panel for that. So there are loads and loads of different options actually that are out there now, which is very different to when I started looking for help sort of 10 11 years ago. But yeah, I also actually think, just to kind of give you a little bit of praise, I actually think just listening to things like this, you know, listening to podcasts, and it's not necessarily always accessing help directly, but just like hearing other people and getting that identification, because that's 99% of a Gamblers Anonymous meeting is listening to other people's stories. So the 1% is sharing what's going on for me.
Yeah, wholeheartedly agree, because it's one of the reasons why this podcast exists in the first place, is we get so much from hearing about other people's stories, whether they're positive, whether they're negative. And there's always something that you can either take away just in terms of your own enjoyment, or something that you might be able to adapt in your own life as well, just by hearing someone else speak. And like you did say, as I've mentioned on these episodes, various links and resources are in the show notes of this podcast. If you do need to go and get any support, places like Samaritans, places like Papyrus, all the links and details are in the show notes of all the podcast episodes. Wow, Chris, it's one of the most open conversations I think we've had on this podcast. And going back to what you said, I think there's so much to take away from what you've been through in your own personal backstory, but you speak so brilliantly on it. And I always have just so much credit for people who can open up in that way on something that's obviously a very sensitive, very personal topic, but they know so much good is going to come out of it as well, and so many learnings to come out of it too. So thank you so much for coming onto the podcast and sharing your own story.
It's been a pleasure to be on the podcast and to be in your company.
Oh, thank you. And likewise, the work that Sporting Chance does as well. Likewise, it was set up for a reason, and it's good to see it performing such a vital role in the lives of so many sports people, because we all love sport. Again, that's one of these reasons why this podcast exists. So every now and again, people need to give a little bit of love back to those athletes when they do need it. Thank you so much, Chris, and take care, everyone. There's more podcast episodes to come, obviously, this week, but look after yourselves, stay safe, and you'll hear from us very soon.